Welcome to Documentary First, an inside look at a first-time filmmaker's journey. I am your host, Josh Lindsay, from the Movie Proposal Podcast. And with us is our first-time filmmaker, Christian Taylor.
Hello, Josh Lindsay.
Christian, you are not in your regular place. You're in a log cabin somewhere.
I am in a log cabin. I am deep in the heart of Wyoming, actually. Pinedale, Wyoming, to be exact. We had a screening here last night. So it'll sound a little different today because I forgot my mic. So hopefully people can endure.
And with us, as always, couldn't do it without him, the awesome, trusty, dusty, research extraordinaire, button-pushing guy, Jason Rugg.
Hey there.
Hey, Jason.
And again, we have a very special guest today with us, all the way from Beaufort Film Festival, is the co-founder of the film festival, Ron Tucker. Ron, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
And Josh.
Yes.
Yeah, Josh, why don't you explain why you just said we have him again?
Well, as I was saying it, I realized what I was doing, and I tried to make it sound like we have a guest again, but it did come across as we have Ron again, which is true. So now I have to explain. This is our second take of this podcast with Ron, who I can't explain why. Maybe Jason can. It just did not work out in the first recording. So Ron was gracious enough to come back a couple of days later and do it again.
Yeah, Jason, why don't you explain why?
Yeah, so I'm still not entirely sure, but we think Christian's computer restarted in the middle of the recording. So we lost chunks of her recording. We lost chunks of Josh's recording. We had Ron. We had me. But we didn't have, you know, the main people who were talking. At the start, at least, Ron took over at the back half and told some great stories. So we're going to dive into those again today.
Yeah.
But before we do, we need a film update. Christian, what is going on with The Girl Who Wore Freedom?
Yeah, we've had an exciting week, not just because I'm in Wyoming, but I really do want to explain what I learned this week because I think it's incredibly helpful. So I want to explain the process of what happened when we went to deliver some of our deliverables for the E&O insurance. One of those is you have to give your distributor all of the legal licenses that you have been given for any of the material in your film that you do not own. And so we have about 4 photos, and we have some audio, and we have some video that we do not own. And I had bought rights for those for film festival uses, and I sent those to the distributor to, you know, check those licenses. I thought they would take over from there and, you know, negotiate everything for me, but that is not what happened. They wrote me a letter back and said, okay, this one is good. This one's good. This one, you need to renegotiate. And I was like, wait a minute. I thought you were going to do that. And one of the ones I was most worried about was the music licensing. That one really was a bear to overcome in the first place. And I anticipated they would give me a much more difficult time and charge me more money just because that's what they do. And he did agree. They said they do have a music licensing, you know, sort of expert on their staff, and they agreed to take that on and negotiate that cost. And then I did the rest. So one of the most exciting things was that we bought the film rights to the black and white footage of Michelle Duvalier, who tells an incredibly, you know, important story in our film. That footage is owned by a house in France called INA.fr. And they, you know, charged me a lot of money up front. It was almost like $3,000. And they told me I was going to have to upgrade for worldwide rights when we got broadcasting. But for whatever reason, the rights that they sent me when they sent me my paperwork said I had 10 years worldwide rights. So that was a huge answer to prayer because it was going to be about $20,000 or something like that to get rights to that. So that was huge. And then in trying to license the photos, I needed to talk with the AP images, and I needed to talk with Getty Images. And what I learned in that situation was that typically a lot of people will go to the online portals and they will buy rights, but those are usually for only one media usage, like a film festival or like a theater. In order to get a usage where it's worldwide rights on all platforms in perpetuity, you really do need to contact a sales agent at those places. And when you do that, they are able to craft things to your needs, and it's much less expensive. So the lesson there is, when you have images that you do need to license, make sure you look for a sales agent at those, you know, at those houses. And the other thing I want to say is, oftentimes those houses like AP and Getty Images and Shutterbox, and there are many more, they will go out and get free images, like from the National Archives. They will put them on their website and then charge you for usage of them. And if you do have the time and the ability to go and get those images yourself, or work with somebody at the National Archives, you can get those for nothing. So that's just something that you need to think about when you're building your budget. Do we want to pay the extra money so we could get them right now? Or do we want to spend some time, work with an, you know, an actual archivist who works at, you know, the National Archives to get them? So that was the biggest thing that happened last week. And then I got in a car after we did our last failed podcast with Ron, and I flew to Colorado Springs, met up with a friend. We drove to Wyoming and we did a screening last night at the Pinedale Public Library. And it was amazing. The people were so wonderful, so interested in the film. They were eager to buy the merchandise I brought. So I made $200 for our little film budget, which is always a blessing. They had lots of questions afterwards. And of course, a filmmaker loves a good Q&A. So that was delightful. And I'll be here through Monday and fly home. So that's my update for the week.
When did you say you arrived?
I think yesterday at like 5 o'clock.
So yesterday was Thursday. You leave on Monday?
Yes.
That seems like a long time, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
I mean,
I was in Beaufort for over a week, I think it felt like. Right, Ron?
Yeah. Yeah, they were. I think 6 days.
Yeah, 6 days. So, you know, when you get an opportunity to go to a place, this is what I love about film festivals. And this is why I went to Beaufort early. These film festival directors and families, because they really are, they put on this big wedding. They spent a lot of time, a lot of money. They have a lot of volunteers who've given their time. And, you know, I love to give honor to all those people who are inviting us and showcasing our film, because when I do that, I am supporting them and also the other filmmakers whose screenings may come before mine. You know, and in doing that, I made relationships with people that now I consider wonderful friends. So that's sort of my mindset about going to film festivals. If I'm going to go, I'm going to be all there. I'm going to take it for everything it's worth. And yeah, so that's my motto.
All right. Well, enjoy your time in Wyoming. We can't wait to hear about the rest of it.
Yeah.
So as we mentioned today, we have a special guest again, the awesome and very gracious Ron Tucker. I'd like to give a quick bio as we introduce him here. So Ron is from South Carolina. He spent 21 years in the Marine Corps before retiring. Thank you.
Hoorah.
Ron. From there, he transitioned from the military into film production, formed the company Sandbar Productions, focusing on a series of documentaries about the Marine Corps and providing content for other television providers such as the History Channel, National Geographic, ABC, CBS, NBC, and so on. And Ron became the chairman of the Beaufort Regional Film Commission and is co-founder of the Beaufort Film Society, of the Beaufort Film Society and co-film festival director. So we are very excited to have him here today. Ron, welcome.
Thank you for having me back.
Well, I just want to give a shout out to Ron's wife, Rebecca. She isn't with us today, but she's a very important part of the Beaufort Film Festival. She just really is the heart and soul. She's an amazing woman. And I know Ron probably agrees with me. I don't know that he could do it without her.
So if she's the heart,
I wouldn't do this if she wasn't right by my side, and we're doing it together. And it's a, we're together 24/7, and I love every second of it. So.
If she's the heart and soul, what are you, Ron?
I'm the feet, I guess. I don't know.
You are the feet and the hands.
Yeah, I guess I'm the one going places and doing things, and we enjoy doing it together. We actually treat it like a job. We have our own duties that we divide. Rebecca is in charge of all the volunteers and a lot of the things that go along with the receptions and the parties, and she gets the liquor license. All those kinds of things that we have to do ourselves. And then we coordinate, and we are the first level jurors. All the films have to get past Rebecca and I before they get to the first level of jurors. And that's a process we can talk about, but it's one of those things that we do it because we're passionate about it. And we've worked together before the film festival with our company, Sandbar Productions and Good to Go Video. We do a lot of meet and greets, meeting the public, and shaking hands. Well, we kind of had to hold up on the shaking hands for now, but other than that, we're in it together. And as long as it continues to be fun, we'll keep doing it.
So Ryan, can you share with us, how did you go from serving in the Marine Corps to, it seemed almost immediately, start a film production company?
Well, when I was in the Marine Corps, my early indoctrination was after boot camp. And of course, I had to do all the things that Marines do. And I was an infantryman, a grunt, which is not what I'd signed up for. My recruiter did not tell me that part. He said, once you join, it's going to be like a 9-to-5 job after boot camp. That is not the way it is. It never was 9-to-5. But anyway, I enjoyed it. I had a great career. About 3 years into my career, I had an opportunity to transition to another occupational specialty, which is administration, which led into public relations, public affairs, which got me into a lot of situations while I was in the service. Public relations was not my primary occupation, but I had a lot of opportunities to do radio and television and things of that sort for the units that I was a part of. And so when I retired, I wanted to settle in Beaufort. Beaufort's a great place. And I said, well, I'll just apply for a job. And being a retired Marine, well, everybody in Beaufort's a retired Marine. So that didn't get me any big credits.
Explain why that is. A lot of people don't know much about Beaufort, so just give us a little bit about Beaufort while you're there.
Okay. Well, Beaufort is right in the center of an area that has two Marine Corps bases. One is the Marine Corps Air Station, and the other is Parris Island, the world famous Marine Corps recruit depot. Parris Island is just 6 miles from downtown Beaufort. And so there's a lot of Marines here, Marine families. In fact, our economy is built around the Marines bases and tourism. We have a lot of Marine families that come here, at least we did pre-COVID. Once that goes away, then they'll come back. They average probably about 3,000 people every single week seeing their son or daughter graduate from boot camp. There are about 38 graduations a year. So that is, basically one of the biggest makeups of Beaufort. And those people are very community oriented. They volunteer for a lot of the organizations like Beaufort Film Society. A lot of those guys come and they do a lot of the schlepping and whatnot, and they enjoy it. They do it for the t-shirt. And of course, we acknowledge them with letters of appreciation, things of that sort. It really helps them as they go on for promotion. So, and I wrote a lot of those over my 22 years as a OIC, officer in charge of units, and had a lot of young Marines that worked with me And they were fantastic. And and I see these guys the same way. That's Beaufort. And then, of course, a lot of people who come here fall in love with Beaufort. And even if they serve here, I served here three times in my 21 years, not counting boot camp. I came back for schools that were here and attended them back in the mid-70s. And then in 1978, I came here for the first time and was an instructor at the admin school, first sergeant school, had a great time. And that put me in front of people. I was not one to really like to stand up and do public speaking, that kind of thing. Well, they just kind of threw me to the wolves and said, you're going to be an instructor. And I was teaching the first sergeants how to be first sergeants, which is kind of strange coming from a staff sergeant at the time. But I enjoyed that experience. And then when I retired, no jobs opened up. I said, you know, here I was 41 years old, retired, which I didn't like the word. I like doing things, being busy. But when it came time to find a job, they weren't all, you know, rolling the red carpet out for me. So even though I said, I'm a retired Marine, well, yeah, so was everybody else. So I played golf for about 8 months until I realized I'm riding around the golf course at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 100 degrees by myself. So I said, there's nobody to play with. So I said, I got to go to work. So that's kind of how it started. I saw that a contract was coming up at Parris Island about video production, filming the recruit families and the graduation itself. So I did some investigation. I said, you know, that sounds like something I might want to get into. You know, I loved video production, even though I didn't even have a video camera. So I started there. I started a location management company thinking I would work with the films that were coming to Beaufort. And then, of course, that was about to dry up.
Tell us about that, because you haven't let us know that there has been film production in Beaufort's past.
Yeah, well, that's the other side of Beaufort. In 1978, Pat Conroy, who was here in Beaufort, Pat Conroy is a very famous author, Southern author, who made his home Beaufort, even though his father was a Marine and stationed here. And Pat was a dependent of him. And his mother said, in the military, when you're going from base to base to base, you don't really have a home. She said, find some place and make it your home. So when he came to high school here, he said, okay, Beaufort's going to be my home. So he stayed here, even though he went back and forth to other places, Italy and Atlanta. He always considered Beaufort his home. He wrote the book, The Great Santini. And somebody along the way thought it was good enough to make a movie about it. And they wanted to make it in Beaufort, South Carolina. So they came here, did their homework, and did the location scouting. And the very first movie to be filmed in Beaufort of about 24 movies was The Great Santini. And it turned out to be great. It starred Blythe Danner, Robert Duvall, who basically all were unknown at the time. And Michael O'Keefe, and it went on and kind of set the tone for future productions. And then later, The Big Chill, people came here for The Big Chill, and they filmed it in the same house, the house that they used in The Great Santini. The director came, the producers came, location scouts came, and Lawrence Kasdan, the director, said, well, show me where The Great Santini is. So I love that movie. So he went to The Great Santini's house, as they were calling it at the time. And he said, I love that house, love the bones of the house. So he said, that's the house I want for The Big Chill. So when you see The Big Chill and all that activity takes place, it's in that one house. There's a lot of backstories to go along with that, with how he got the actors to stay together for a month, just getting to know each other and get on each other's nerves, so that when they had those scenes in the house, that they acted like they knew each other. And So it, that was a lot of fun. And then as time went on, people came and said, we're going to go to Alabama and shoot this movie Forrest Gump, but Dale Dye, someone you met, Christian, Dale Dye said Robert Zemeckis, he said, I know a place that has the perfect place to do these Vietnam scenes. He remembered Fripp Island and Honey Island State Park that could conform to become a jungle in Vietnam. So they came here and looked at it, and then boom, they decided that we're going to shoot just about all of Forrest Gump here. Savannah, those from Savannah are listening. I know you have the bench and you know, claim Forrest Gump, but we like to claim most of Forrest Gump being filmed here in Beaufort. All the iconic scenes, if you remember, in the early stages of the home that, where Sally Field and was the mom in that movie. And you saw people here all the time when they were, all these different places were filming. I was running one day, back when I used to do that all the time. And I ran into Sally Field walking her dog. And so in a little while later, I was running in the same exact spot several years later and ran into Nick Nolte riding his bicycle. Nick
was goodness.
Yeah, Nick was here for The Prince of Tides, which was another movie based on a book by Pat Conroy. So Pat got it started here. And then as other people came and discovered Beaufort, it just kept going from there. We had G.I. Jane, Something to Talk About, Rules of Engagement, The Jungle Book. The jungle scenes in the Walt Disney movie Jungle Book were filmed here in Beaufort. And The Last Dance with Sharon Stone. Well, look at my wall over there. Well, of course, I have the Rules of Engagement, Big Chill, and Forrest Gump hanging on the wall. But we have at the at the Chamber of Commerce, we have annually a museum, more or less, they create right before the film festival, and we take all of our movie posters down there, so you can come. It's kind of a history of filmmaking in Beaufort. So it's quite a list, and like I said, that I thought that when I retired, I would jump in there and I'd become a location scout and all this kind of thing. And all I wound up doing was working for catalogs, because catalog business and photo shoots were big. So my first job as a scout was for Talbot's, the clothing company, which was great. And where do you think I set them up for their photo shoot? At the Big Chill House. They wanted it. They came here from Boston. I showed them all of these houses that they wanted. They wanted an antebellum house with a wraparound porch and all these kinds of things. And I said, okay, I'll find you some. Well, I'd already been told, because of tourists wanting to sightsee and walk past the Big Chill House. That's what it becomes, whatever movie was there most recently. It's no longer the Great Santini House anymore. It's the Big Chill House. So I said, they said, well, what about the Big Chill House? I said, well, it's not available. Why isn't it available? I said, well, the people that live there, they decided they didn't want tourists peering through the fence all the time. And I thought, well, we're not going to keep adding to that history. So one thing led to another, and they were not satisfied. So I took them down Bay Street, as you know, it's right on the water, but it's like our main drive. And I showed them all these houses that the owners had already decided that they would let them use their house. And then the other scout from Boston looked at me and says, Ron, what did they tell you this catalog shoot was for? And I said, well, it was a clothing catalog. She said, did they tell you it was for intimate apparel? I said, no. I said, obviously you can't use those houses that are right there on Main Street because they were going to be shot on the porches. So we didn't use those houses. So then I was like desperate. I said, this is my first job as a scout and I'm going to blow it. So I went and swung the gate open at the Big Chill House and walked up to the door, and the little chihuahua came out, snipping at my heels. And And a gentleman on the porch said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Yes, sir." I said, "I'm a scout for Talbots." And he said, "Talbots?" He said, "What's that?" And then the older lady came out. She said, "You mean those clothes people?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "Okay, I'm interested." And I ran back to my car and got the two people from Boston and took them over there. And I said, "You guys negotiate from here." And one thing led to another. And they said, "We got the house." I said, "Well, son of a gun." So that was the start of my scouting career. From then I got Neiman Marcus and Avon and a whole bunch of others, Crate and Barrel, but no movies that actually got shot here. I scouted for movies that they decided they didn't want to shoot here after I showed them things. But that was the start. And that led to wanting to stay in the business. I was registered to film office as a scout. And as the jobs came along, and, you know, then I got contacted because I was in that book at the film office from one of the screenwriters for JAG, the TV show, and they were doing a story about Marines. So he sought me out because I listed myself as a technical advisor also. So one thing led to another, and he sent me the script back in the days of dial-up, and the script, it took about 3 days, I think, to come in, but it finally came in. And then I printed it on a fax machine that had the thermal fax paper, and I couldn't read half of it after I printed it. But in any case, it was not a good scene for the Marines, so I sent it back to him. And then the screenwriter came back later and said, "Ron, guess what? We've both been fired. They didn't like the edits on the script." So they went ahead and produced it anyway. And then when they did, they got a lot of flack from the Marine Corps because it wasn't what the Marine Corps would like to see. So I sat back and said, "I told you so." So anyway, when the job came over at Paris Island and I bid on it, I wrote a script and I had to produce a demo that would be seen by the folks over there making the decision. And I didn't have all the bells and whistles that, but I knew the job, knew what needed to be included. So after I included all those things, they loved it, but they decided to give the bid back to the person who had it. So I was stuck with a $14,000 demo. And then later a company that also bid didn't get it, asked me what we were going to do with ours. And I said, "Well, I'm going to finish it and make it a full documentary." And they wanted to join forces. So I went to their studio in Charleston, South Carolina, and saw what a film production studio really looks like. I was working out of my office at home and didn't have any of the equipment, but I had the knowledge. And so one thing led to another, and we decided to form a company that would produce documentaries about the Marine Corps. So that was in 1994. So it just kind of, that launched us there. That's how we got into film production.
So I want to just point out a couple of things. That was amazing. Thank you for sharing all of that with us. There are people that listen to us that aren't in the film industry, and there are other people that are first-time listeners. And you said a few things I just want to draw attention to. One of the things you kept mentioning was the Film Commission. And I think it's important that we stop and explain. Most towns or cities or states do have some sort of film office. And, you know, it's very important for them to sort of market their state or their town to production companies, because when a film comes into a place, it brings a lot of economy into that little area. And filmmakers, location scouts, makeup artists, I mean, everything all over the board, if you live in that state, it behooves you to register yourself like Ron did as one of those things. And so film commissions are extremely important. And one of the things I loved at your film festival, Ron, was that you did put together this little trailer This is another element of the film festival that I really enjoy. You put together a trailer of movies that were filmed in Beaufort that people know, and you would play those in between, you know, when you were switching over things. And what was so great for me as a filmmaker, I was like, oh yeah, that location is amazing. And I didn't know that was filmed here. And I can see how I could use this place in my film, that kind of thing. And it does get the filmmakers there beginning to think about what they could do. And that is the whole point of the Film Commission's job, which is to entice filmmakers to see a location as a viable place to film. And they try to make it very friendly for filmmakers. And I did wonder, does South Carolina have a tax credit? They do, don't they?
We have, your question is very timely because we're working with the South Carolina Film Office, and I was on the Carolina Film Alliance, which is a nonprofit advocate for production in South Carolina. They augment, really, the South Carolina Film Office. The film incentives, which is what most states have, they either have a tax credit or tax rebate. South Carolina has the rebate, which means you have to spend it to get it. I mean, there's certain, you know, things that you have to present during the final audit. They have a $1 million minimum for the film budget. You have to have it's safer to come in with a budget of, say, $1.5 million, because there's a lot of things they're going to tell you that don't count. So if you get rid of about $500,000 and you still have $1 million budget, then you could qualify for the film incentives in South Carolina. Which is I don't want to give false information, but on the South Carolina Film Office website, it breaks it down. And it's fairly competitive for states our size. Nowhere near competitive to Georgia. Georgia, right next door to us, is a mega giant now in film production. The people are moving from LA and New York and even Louisiana to work on film and television in Georgia. Atlanta is booming. In South Carolina, we're between South Carolina and North Carolina. North Carolina has double the incentives that we have. So South Carolina doesn't have the incentives that we're hoping for. When all these films were being made here, we were strictly what people considered a location state. We had the locations that could be just about anybody you wanted us to be. Whether it was the Old South, New York, when the Barbra Streisand scene, when Nick Nolte is holding that violin, the Stradivarius, over the balcony, that was built here. That was actually a set that was built here in Beaufort. It's supposed to be an apartment in New York. So we conformed to, we transformed to anything. But we have a rebate system, which means when you present all of your receipts and the audit takes place, you're written a check for that percentage that you qualified for. Whereas a credit, like in Georgia, they're transferable credits. If you don't use up all the credits, you can transfer those credits to another state, for example, and use those credits in another state. And that's one of the things that people that have the rebate systems don't want to get into. They want to make sure if you're going to spend money, you're going to spend it in that state.
And they can also sell them. So you know, the production companies can sell that tax credit for money. So it's right. It's a tradable commodity. And really, filmmakers, of course, do prefer that. But they would prefer to film in a state that does have something. So it is good that, you know, South Carolina has something. And it is growing. Like, I was surprised to hear about Wilmington, North Carolina, and what North Carolina was doing there. So I would encourage filmmakers definitely to look in South Carolina and North Carolina. And Ron, you are a key person, I feel, in that industry, because you know so many people. And I think, you know, the film festival brings a lot of those people together. And so I do want to turn to talk about the film festival. And I want you to give us sort of pull back the curtain for, you know, what it is like for, you know, film directors as they are viewing films or as they are considering filmmakers. What do filmmakers need to know when they are, you know, submitting to a film festival? And what's the experience like for you?
That's a very good question, because one of the things that we try to do with the film festival is introduce that newest generation of filmmakers to Beaufort. That's why we started it in the first place. It was an offshoot of the incentives that we were talking about, and we weren't getting anywhere. So that's when the idea was proposed to have a film festival and hopefully bring the filmmaker to us. Now, when we started the film festival, and our first one in 2007, we were just learning, meaning I was just learning. Yeah, I had no idea how important it was at that time to have the filmmaker here. So the first couple of years, I didn't really concentrate. I concentrated on getting the film submitted to Beaufort, we called Beaufort Film Festival then, and we added international a few years later. But then went to a couple of film festivals and said, wait a minute, you know, we're not doing a lot of things that we should be doing. So we kind of pulled that curtain back, as you said, and said, let's make this all about the filmmaker. You know, get them here, get their films here, but make it tough enough that, you know, we couldn't make the entry fee free, because we did that. We tried that too. And you get, if you make it free, the people figure it's not worth anything. So, so we finally learned to have a balance there to make it affordable. And those people, the filmmakers, are going to look at your film festival and pick and choose and see if they are a fit to you. So putting yourself in the position of a filmmaker, the one thing that Beaufort fights against is, like you said, no one knows what Beaufort is or where Beaufort is. If you say Key West Film Festival, then you know where you're going. You're going to Key West, or you say Bermuda Film Festival. And if you say, you know, Nashville Film Festival, but you say Beaufort, South Carolina, yeah. So we decided to make it to where coming to Beaufort with your film would be an experience that you weren't going to forget. So we pretty much built everything around the red carpet experience for that filmmaker. Having said that, we also make sure that the film that's selected is a top quality film, and the filmmaker who made it is, you know, going to come and have an experience and have an audience. When we established the film festival, we were surprised to find that there's a lot of retirees that are here that love going to theater, Broadway. I mean, all the arts, all the cultural things they were missing. And then to come to Little Beaufort and have a film festival, an international film festival. So people started coming to our film festival, and each year it kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And as that started to happen, we made sure that the films that we selected were at least on par with the ones that were selected the previous year. And then it kept getting to where the quality of the films through word of mouth of the filmmaker was, you've got to submit to this film festival if you want this Beaufort hug and Southern hospitality, and then just see this beautiful, beautiful area and find out why all these motion pictures were filmed there. So we pretty much established a criteria for filmmakers that we want them to want to come here, want to be selected. And as time went on, we started thinking, not that we wanted to make it as too tough to get into, but we didn't want people to think, well, I'm going to go to Sundance. We had people that held off submitting to us because they said, we're being considered for Sundance. I don't know how they would ever know that if you're being considered for Sundance or South by Southwest. And the reason they don't want to submit is because you have to be a first, you have to be a premiere at Sundance or South by Southwest. So if you've already been selected at a film festival and already announced, then they won't accept you. So we battled that for a few years and then finally said, you know what? We don't care about the other film festivals. So we just tailored it to Beaufort. And as word got out and we became friends with the filmmakers, because that's the other thing we do is we try to become friends. I mean, you're a filmmaker, but we want to we want you to know us before you get here. So for about 2 months before our film festival, we're engaged with the filmmakers. We're seeing what they need. This is the airport you need to fly into. As best we can, we're going to provide you a room. We're going to feed you while you're here. If you don't like what we have, we'll tell you where the nearest restaurant is, has the best shrimp in the area, or barbecue or whatever. And most people don't want to leave. You know, they come here and says, oh, is it over already? And so that's the experience that we try to build. And there's several layers to that. And if you ask me which layer, I don't want to go on and on and on, but based on your own experience, which is in a COVID year, which we, you know, we decided to do an in-person film festival against a lot of people telling me not to. But I guess the Marine in me says we can do this and we're going to do this. And it was the Hell with the Devil Film Festival, you know? So we got it done. We're 6 weeks past the film festival. We had no reports of anybody testing positive or getting sick. And so thank God for that. But yeah, we count on the filmmaker. The filmmaker is very, very important, because you have one filmmaker that comes and has a bad experience. That's why we go to the extra lengths to make sure that everything is going to be perfect. You check into your room, you knew it was going to be there. We have the swag bag on the bed, or at least to check in when you got there. I have already checked your movie to make sure it plays perfectly. The slightest little hiccup, you can expect me to be there before the filmmaker is there. Because I'm back, I said, why is that out of sync, you know, or something like that. And just the little thing. So we, next to the filmmaker being the most persnickety about their film, how it looks and how it sounds, would be me right there with you. So, but we just take a lot of extra care to make sure that that experience is a good one.
Well, and I just want to testify, I told Josh in a text message I was done with questions, but I didn't. but I do want to testify to my experience, because most film festivals do not, it's not common for them to provide lodging. It is not common for them to provide food. There are some film, you know, it's, I don't know how many film festivals don't even give actual physical awards. There are some that do, but it's like to the top three filmmakers or whatever. One of the big differences is with the Buford Film Festival, in my experience, all of the filmmakers were on an equal footing, and they tried to treat the people that submitted shorts with as much dignity as they did the people that, you know, have these big award-winning films. And everybody got the Buford hug, and you have succeeded in your goal of making it so memorable. I keep trying to figure out how the heck can I get back there? I want to produce a movie just to submit it just so I can get back there. And I want to film there. What can I shoot there? I was lobbying to find stories in Beaufort that I could shoot while I was there. So it's a very special place, very special film festival. And I would highly encourage any filmmaker to submit. So now I'm done.
Well, as we're kind of nearing the end here, I wanted to ask Ron, as someone who had a whole career prior to filmmaking and then just decided to like, hey, let's pick up a camera and give this a go because I like it, what advice do you have to new filmmakers, regardless of their age or their career background, you know, just getting started right now in this age that we live in? What advice would you give to a new filmmaker?
One of the first things would be to tune into this podcast, because I've learned some things, especially from Christian's experience about some of the deliverables that you have to present to go through. But I would suggest that, you know, if you're going to submit to a film festival, make sure that that film festival feels the love back, because film festivals, when we get a film submitted, for example, and we see that film has already been in 50 other film festivals, and it's just because either, you know, it's just going to be another notch in the gun or whatever. We want to make sure that you, if you're selected, be prepared to go to that film festival. Don't submit to a film festival that you just want to be selected and put it a laurel on your poster that says, I was selected at the Beaufort International Film Festival, because we're counting on you to want to come to the film festival and present your film, and then do the Q&A after the film, network with other filmmakers. I can't begin to tell you how many filmmakers have come and met each other and are now collaborating on projects, and they have submitted the film festival. I mean, submitted projects back to us where they work together on it. So that makes us feel pretty good, because especially when we found that they met here. A lot of times they met somewhere else, and that relationship builds from the film festival circuit. But for all new filmmakers, I would suggest, first, you know, if the screenwriting, make sure you have a good script. Make sure it's in accordance with all the elements of having a good screenplay. And then make sure that when you shoot it professionally. One of the things that we see with films that come in, that people don't concentrate on the audio. Audio is important. And if you have the best picture, the best story, but if your audio sucks, you're probably not going to get selected. At the same time, we have had films that come in, and if you're shooting back into the light and you can't really see the images, I mean, kind of learn the craft first and then test those films on people you know, and it's going to tell you, you know, if you have a good film or not. And if you're submitting a short film, your chances of getting into a film festival, especially our film festival, is if your short is 20 minutes or less. If you have a short that's 39 minutes, which is right on the edge of being a feature, 40 minutes or more is considered a feature. If you submit one that's 39 minutes, it better be very, very good. Because when we're programming, basically that's when I'm programming, I'm looking for as many films and as many filmmakers as I can get into the festival. And if I have three great films that are 15 minutes each, short films now, and I have one that's 39 minutes, your 39-minute film better be better than those three that were 18 minutes or 15 minutes, because that's just depriving somebody else of that. I mean, it's just, you know, and I think all film festivals like shorter is better. And then the Q&A, I mean, be prepared to talk about your film. We've had young filmmakers, student filmmakers that would come up, get on stage. It's just me and that person, and they're like a deer in the headlights. They can't talk about their film, the process of making the film, because somebody's going to ask a question, how much did it cost you to make that film? Or where did you get the idea for the film? Just have all that ready to talk about. And I think as time goes on from festival to festival, we've had people that came, we were their first film festival. They came back 5 years later. It's like, who is that person? I mean, I asked one question, that was it. And then they filled up their 10 minutes. So. But that would be the thing that I would recommend to them, is be genuine. Only submit to those film festivals you plan on going to. You know, if you're selected, then already someone's telling you that you have a quality film. We've raised the bar so high over the years that, we hate to see some films not get selected, but we just don't have enough time to take them all.
Ron, if someone is going to be out in Beaufort or they want to learn about the film festival, what's the website where they can connect with you?
Well, if they go to BeaufortFilmFestival.com, there's a lot of drop-down tabs there. Just have to kind of scroll across and see which ones drop down. But as it gets closer to the film festival, we start putting more information. A lot of the selections aren't made until December 15th. So from December 15th to our festival, which is late February, usually, a lot of information is going to change every day. Up until that point, then we're promoting like Beaufort Film Society, which is a membership-driven organization, and we try to get as many members into the Film Society as we can, because later on, those people are going to be our audience, and those people are going to be our sponsors, hopefully. And without both of those, we couldn't put on the film festival. So it's kind of a learn as you go for each filmmaker, because if they haven't done a film festival before, and we try to educate all the students. We have great student filmmakers that come here, and we a lot of times are their first experience. And we try to tell them it's downhill from here. So you've already been to see us, and they're going to compare us. And of course, I'm joking with them at the time, but they've all come back and said, "Hey, that was right. We went to another film festival, and you know, we want to come back to Beaufort." And what Christian said, a lot of them leave here saying, "I got to go make another film so I can have a reason to go back to Beaufort." So, and that's,
well, hey,
that's
Ron, one of the things. Ron, real quick, Christian wants to know, as the rest of our listening audience, June 6th, what's happening on June 6th?
Well, June 6th this year, Beaufort Inn, which is one of our marquee inns here in Beaufort, we have partnered with them, and we're going to be doing a garden, what they call a garden party. And on June 6th, we have selected, because it is D-Day, the Girl Who Wore Freedom to appear or to screen at the garden party. It's one of those, bring your lawn chairs, bring your kids. It's a kickoff of the summer for us. And it's a Sunday. So we are expecting to have a lot of folks downtown in June for a lot of reasons. A lot of people get married here. So we're looking to have, and if things work out with Christian, may get to be here for that as well. But we're going to kick off our summer series with The Girl Who Wore Freedom on June 6th.
Woo-hoo!
That's fantastic. Woo-hoo! All right. Well, hey, Ron, we really appreciate you coming on the podcast two times. And, actually, you know, I feel bad for our podcast listeners, because we got to hear some of the same stories, but we got to hear a lot of other new stories. And so there's things they're just missing out on. So you really need to find a way to make, you know, to get to Beaufort, meet Ron, go to the film festival. So really enjoyed our time with you today. So thanks for being on with us.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me. And yeah, y'all come down and visit. Come down and check it out.
Christian, can you remind us, for those who want to make a donation to the Girl Who Wore Freedom, or buy some swag, where can they go?
TheGirlWhoWoreFreedom.com/donate or TheGirlWhoWoreFreedom.com/shop. There are plenty of videos there, blogs there, lots of ways to interact with us. So we really would love you to follow our journey. And if you are a filmmaker, write us. Let us know what you've learned about this film. Leave a comment on iTunes or on our website. And, you know, maybe you could come on our podcast and talk about what you're doing as well. So thank you guys for listening to the podcast, and Josh and Jason for hosting. Thank you, Ron, for being here. Hopefully we can have you back, because there's other stories we didn't get to record this time.
Right.
Okay. Sounds good.
Well, thanks everyone for listening to Documentary First, where we believe everyone has a story to tell, and you can be the one to tell it.
Yes, you can. Bye, everybody.
Hello.
Thank you for listening to Documentary First. We really appreciate your partnership with us. We can't do any of this without you. So thank you so much for listening, for donating, and for following along on our journey. If you are able to make a donation this week, we would really appreciate it. We are supported by donors who give us $100 or less, so anything helps. Also, if you're able to share the news about The Girl Who Wore Freedom with your friends and family, please do that on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or email. And sign up for our newsletter at thegirlwhowarefreedom.com. Please go to thegirlwhowarefreedom.com/donate to make a donation today.